Just two little details from leftover from last time. I pronounced that word wrong. It's dithyram, not dithyram. Dithyram.
Where?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say that. This text becomes dithyrambic. Dithyrambic. Page 356. Song of Victory. I said dithyram. It's dithyram. In dithyrambic. Dithyrambic. It's not a bad word to know, because those of you who did the Nietzsche seminar, Zarathustra is completely dithyrambic. It means wildly enthusiastic. And without a concise form. The form is in the intensity. And it comes from, as I mentioned, that I was correct. The dithyram was the style of the song to Dionysus, and because that was ecstatic. And why it's so important is the drama came out of the dithyram. They used to sing, like Brian mentioned this, that they used to sing to the dying god or to the resurrecting god. And then one day somebody got an idea to put one person outside of the chorus and talk to the chorus. And that was the first play. Mm-hmm. And that eventually became drama. It's amazing. Well, no, it did not. These have not survived.
Oh, really?
But if you look at the very earliest plays of Aeschylus, there will be like two or three actors and a chorus.
Yeah.
So you can still see it there. And the chorus then was the chorus singing to Dionysus. Uh-huh. So that's how. I got on that. I think I may have mentioned this. I went back to my fraternity. Did I ever tell you that dream? I went back to my fraternity where we used to do all sorts of nasty things in the party room. And I went back to the party room, and they were putting on theater. And that led me then to look at the origins of the word, origins of theater. And that's where it comes from. It comes out of the drunken revelries to Dionysus. And comedia was the word used for the song to Dionysus that was his rebirth. And so that's where comedy comes from. And tragos it means goat song, and that was the song to Dionysus as the dying goat, and that's the origin of the word tragedy. Very fascinating. And I think it's so important because people who are creative usually have gone through quite a wild time in their life. And, you know, some of them never get out of it. But I think that's why, that really the passion to create starts in that wildness. And unless you've lived out your own wildness, you don't ever get to the real creativity. It's really one of the problems of the creative personality and why they are so close to disillusion. But if they don't have it, they don't have it. And in my case, you know, that crazy beginning I had, I mean, like some of you know, I'm lucky I'm alive. We had car accidents driving to the bar, much less driving back from the bar. And passion then got channeled into my love of Jungian psychology, and I think that's what that dream was saying. And now, really, I'm a social drinker, but I really don't have much of a need to raise hell at all. And it's not out of, like, oh, I shouldn't. It's out of, this is more interesting. This is much more interesting. So, in a way, you could say that there's a dithyrambic dimension to all of Aurora, which is, you know, we've seen in the flood, the darkness, he is being overpowered by an emotional experience. And what he's trying to get to then is to extract the meaning out of the experience. So that's why she uses the word dithyrambic. And you'll hear Jung use it. And it comes out of the fact that I think you could say Dionysus really is the origin of culture. And even, you know, in classical Greece, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, that the plays were put on in festivals for Dionysus. And they were done in the afternoon, but most of them went sloshed. It was a big party. And they put on plays, and they had contests. So the origin of culture really does come out of the ecstatic experience, and hopefully what we can do now is tame that down a little bit and get the intensity without having to have the destruction or the addictive behavior that often goes along with it. But it gives you a sense of why artists often are, you know, Tennessee Williams and Mozart and Beethoven, for that matter, and Nietzsche, and
Will that be then the shadow side of the creative personality? Is the tortured soul?
Yeah, and you've got to have it, or you don't create anything with any juices in it. And if you have it without moderation, you'll burn up.
It'll be very Nietzsche, right?
Yeah, and Nietzsche, I think, burned up. But the Romantic poets, how many of them made 35? Same story.
It's
very fascinating. And you can, I love Greek tragedy, and if you've seen Greek tragedy performed in its original, you feel that. There's a vitality in that stuff that I think O'Neill, say, captures it, and Tennessee Williams captures it, but often Shakespeare, of course, but I mean the greats, but often what you're seeing on the stage now is like just pablum as opposed to the pouring out of the heart. The other detail, which is again very small, but if you're an aficionado, I just wanted to confirm Gerhard Dorn was a student of Paracelsus. Paracelsus was the big alchemist that Jung liked so much. He lived in a little town outside of Zurich called Einsiedeln. It's about half an hour drive.
Black Madonna there.
The Black Madonna is there. And Jung studied him very closely. I think he felt a sort of kindred, because Paracelsus was a doctor and an alchemist and refused to play ball. Gerhard Dorn, the guy we talked about, who came up with the three stages of the conjunctio. Remember, we had the unio mentalis, unio corporalis, which is what we'll be starting today, and then the unis mundus. So Jung took a great deal from both of those people. Quick review. We've looked at the overpowering nature of this experience, the darkness, the flood. I've gone through this, but I just want you to keep hearing this and realize that the different dimensions over the overpowering nature of the Sophia experience, the darkness, the flood, the prison was the inaccessibility of the meaning, the Holy Spirit, his attempt to funnel this thing back into church theology. Then in the chapter where the house was, we saw really the deeper intent of this experience in that image of the sun, the light of the sun and the moon in the house. So that was announcing a new understanding of what religious experience is, a new understanding of what God is. It wasn't the sun and the moon, that would be antiquity. It wasn't the light of God, as it was in the book of Revelation. It was a light, but a light from the union of the sun and the moon. So a new understanding is being presented, or an image of a new understanding of what God is being presented in that vision. And Thomas, he gets that it's a religious experience, but he can't quite understand how that experience is trying to get him to reevaluate the nature of Christian theology. At his time, and then for us also. The next chapter was on the earth. We talked about the earth in a pile of different ways. I won't repeat all that, but hopefully you can see that how he's been flooded by an experience. He tries to shove it back into ecclesiastical doctrine. It reasserts itself as a new image of divinity. And then the next chapter is the chapter on the earth, which, making it very, very simple, would mean, now, Thomas, make this real, which, of course, he can't do. But that's how the psyche is generating how it sees integration of the experience could go. It keeps producing the steps in the integration, even though he can't himself follow up with it, but we can learn what to expect. what we'll go on today is now taking the representative of the earth. This will all become clearer, but the image which represents the earth in this next chapter, which we'll get to in a minute, is getting re-infused with life. So the idea is that an experience was had, the psyche shows the path of extracting the meaning out of the experience, and then we're going to see the psyche's attempt at producing images which show the need to take that understanding back into the reality of one's life and reanimate life. That's just a very broad outline of how this chapter is going to fit in. Something I talked about last time, I just wanted to touch on. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. It's not exactly on our point, but when I listened to the tape, I thought, well, I'm not sure how well I explained this, so let's see if I can just get the essence of it. Somebody said, do these Sophia experiences have to be the way it goes? I think Sandy has that. And I said, no. And I talked about Jung's different paradigms. I won't repeat that. But I did say, and I do feel, that when it's a question of developing a new understanding of who you are, or if I use psychological language, when it's a question of developing a new self, and that self is to be politically and socially relevant, it's more likely that you will get that new self through this process. That's my two cents. Jung doesn't say that anywhere. And I tried to present a model for that. And if you can think of the Sophia experience as bottom up, you have an emotional experience. Ah, here he comes. Thank you. Thank you very much. You have an emotional experience, and extract out of that an understanding of who you are, what the self is asking of you, what the configuration of your life is to be. We've talked about that. So if you can imagine, you got this image of the self here. What I have been playing with a little bit is from another point of view, this historian Toynbee talks about the self of an artist as being shaped by that artist dealing with, to make a long story short, dealing with inside themselves the problems that are going on in the outside world. Thank you. Problems going on in the outside world surfacing in the unconscious of the creative personality, and that creative personality working on that problem and in solving that problem directing the society in its growth. And what I wanted to try to convey is that they're the same. You can look at it from the bottom up or from the top down, and the way we're going to see it is that that new self comes out of your wrestling with an emotional, instinctual, libidinous, or aggressive instinct, basically, and then extracting out of that your identity. And that would be one way to look at it. But another way to look at it, which would be equally valid, is that that self is shaped by the problems of the time surfacing in your unconscious, and in your working on them, you become the sort of person who knows the solution of the problems of the time in yourself. And in your expressing your struggle, you begin to be a beacon for the struggles of the society.
So you're saying both are a Sophia.
And they are two different dimensions of the same thing. That the Sophia experience is, at the same time, you're discovering within yourself what's going on in the society. And we see that in your art, how your art picks up the issue of body and spirit. In a way, it's a personal issue. In a way, it's the issue of our time. And in presenting this art, you give people a way to talk about it and reflect on themselves, and that's the way culture evolves. And it's two different aspects of the same thing. So this Sophia experience, I think, is more likely to occur when what you're about is to be historically, communally, politically relevant, or even a leader, a guide. Not a leader necessarily in running for Congress, but in having a voice that initiates discussions, that gets people reflecting on themselves, that leads to change. I think it shows, for me, the next step in the research of Jungian psychology, that we begin to understand how the inner process and the outer process are really two different sides of the same thing. Jung only did this because, as I always said, he had one big problem, and that was he only had one lifetime. It's up to the next generation to explore this, and I think there's a lot of food. It's relevant to this Sophia stuff because, you see, it breaks down matter and spirit, and it breaks down inner and outer. If you're doing your inner journey to the full, it leads you back to the world. It's very, very important, I think. Jung didn't necessarily emphasize that part because he was too busy figuring out the symbolism of the inner dimension of it. But I think it's very exciting. Okay, a couple of specific points from last time. 353, for all things serve the earth, is in the quote in the middle of the page, which is a paraphrase of Psalm 118, for all things serve thee. For all things serve the earth, 353. For all things serve the earth, as a paraphrase of for all things serve thee, of Psalm 118:91, and she's just again emphasizing that the earth is the beginning and the end of the experience. And what she's saying, in my words, all things serve the earth, that's just another way of saying what I just said, that this inner Sophia process leads you back to your role in the community. And a change in that role, and therefore looking at it from the point of view of the community, to your contribution to that community. And I think you'll see in any deep process, both processes are going on. It's an inner process, and it's an outer process. We talked a little bit about the phrase that she uses on page 355, the corrupting humidity and the divine water. 353, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 lines down after the quote. It's nothing new, it's just a phrase, how we... to express what we've been saying, that the Sophia experience has a difficult beginning, which seems poisonous or upsetting or even bad. It seems corrosive to what you wish your life to be doing at the moment, and yet that is the first appearance of the divine water. Um, 355 at the bottom and over, she just mentions how she feels the text is alluding to this development being an inner one. Nothing new, just hearing her message.
456.
That was 355 at the bottom. But in our text, the city of God is the immortal body or the immortal inner man.
Just to interject something here, this is fascinating because we're seeing this inner-outer struggle acted out in our times, obviously. But there is a certain mindset, a rigid mindset, which we label fundamentalist, that is thinking that it's acting out this inner drama, but in a very, very narrow focus. And my question is that the Sophia experience actually it is successfully dealt with, worked with consciously, it encourages a type of flexibility mm-hmm. and openness as opposed
yeah,
to rigidity.
Absolutely.
So are we seeing the shadow side in the fundamentalist activities, both mm-hmm. in the West and in the East, or in the world present, or however we want to put it, but are we seeing in the shadow side of the fact that we're not consciously, we're not making conscious as far as this Sophia work?
I understand your question.
Fundamentalists are really evil.
No, not evil. Is that they're the shadow side. We're seeing the shadow side in the news, let's say, of the work that's not going on consciously in the rest of it. Not enough of this or whatever. Well, is it fair to view it that way?
I just want to give you a full answer. Because it's funny, I was just talking to a colleague this morning who some of us did the Zarathustra here, the ones that look a little demented. and he's starting a Zarathustra seminar with a bunch of people in his town. And I was saying to him how I did not understand this dimension of that book when we did it, because the events in history that it portended hadn't occurred yet. Zarathustra is from Iran and Iraq.
Yeah, of course.
Think about that. In Nietzsche's Unconscious, the challenge to Western values would come from the Middle East.
Wow.
That just blows my mind. Because I often thought, Nietzsche, why did you pick Zarathustra? And who cares? I often said that while reading that book. Of all the interesting figures in Western myth that he could have picked, he picks Zarathustra. And that must have been the sureness of his intuition, 150 years ahead of time. And what Zarathustra is coming back to make us realize is the inadequate way our values work. That's basically what Zarathustra is doing in there. As Jung interpreted it, not knowing Islam would present this complication to us, is that Zarathustrianism, according to the way Jung worked with it, presented the conflict in life as a conflict between good and bad. And the way Nietzsche works with Zarathustra, then, is to say, well, Zarathustra is coming back to heal that first limited understanding of morality. Well, first of all, you've seen how relevant that is to the Sophia experience. You cannot approach this with old ideas of right and wrong. There is a morality in it, but it's much different than the old idea of right and wrong. So I think what we're going through today is a fundamental challenge to Western values. And I would take the fundamentalism, at least in the West, as an inability to stand that confrontation. And what they do, they bolster the old idea of right and wrong, fearing if we give up this definition of right and wrong, what's left?
Yeah.
Well, think of that dream of the woman with the affair. It didn't care that she was an adulteress, but it did care that she'd been an adulteress twice. So there is a morality, but it is not that you give up the old morality and you flip into hedonism, which was partly Nietzsche's misunderstanding of what he was saying, because he was willing to accept that that was an alternative. But you can see right within the unconscious, below the Ten Commandments, there is another morality. And it's that shift from the sureness of right and wrong to knowing there still is right and wrong, but it is not clear any longer what is right and what is wrong. It generates so much anxiety that fundamentalism is a reaction against that shift. Relevant to this material, because you need that second, you have to approach this material with a greatly differentiated sense of morality, but it can't be the old sense that if you have sex with a married person, you're bad. Unconscious doesn't care. Absolutely does not care. Even applaud you. But yet, in another way, it has its own very, very strict rules.
Seems to me the difference, I was thinking about it when I was listening to last time again, and it seems that there was a level of consciousness that was not there the first time, but was there the second time.
In her.
That she...
Yeah, I would agree with okay. that. I would agree with that,
and,
yeah.
And that, for me, was the difference. Mm-hmm. She had an affair the second time mm-hmm. with the wisdom that she had
right.
found.
Right.
Then that wouldn't have
right.
been...
Right. It would not have been okay.
No.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But if she was still in that muck...
Yeah.
And so could we say that this more authentic morality is something that is discovered by the individual as opposed to institutions?
Definitely. Yeah, oh, definitely. And, if you know, I hate to use these Jungian words. You know, Jung never used these words. But sometimes you have to. That it seems to be in the service of individuation. And as we've seen, that this individuation process at points does not care about traditional values, but in a deeper sense is really generously interested in the welfare of life. But it's murky. I'm still a little blown away by that Zarathustra stuff that Nietzsche's... Yeah. And that would be an example, too, you see, of how Nietzsche got this thing from the bottom up. And that really was his problem. Yeah, he was a prude. He's probably a virgin. Or the only women he slept with were prostitutes. I mean, a huge Christian problem, which is ironic for the guy who sounds like he's moving way past. Well, he's moving way past it in his vision, and that vision is...
He was a chosen lover, too, so maybe he's... Right. There's the
from, what's her name? I can't think of her name. She was a knockout.
Yeah, power.
Of course, he met her and he proposed to her an hour later. that may have something to do with it. it'll come to us. Any case, I just wanted to give you, try to put this in a little larger context, too, that she was Rilke's lover and friend of Freud. Can't think of her name. Put this in a little wider context. We talked about the first and the second Adam on 356. Just another word for the beginning state and the end state. And I have told you this before, and I've forgotten I even told you that. The first Adam, of course, is Adam. And the second Adam is another word for Christ, and that comes from St. Paul. First Corinthians 15:45. The last Adam, he contrasts Jesus Christ as the last Adam in contrast to the first Adam.
He's not only second but last.
Well, as Christianity does it. And I think what Jung wants us to get out of that is the fact that the Christians saw that they were both Adams, that's equivalent psychologically to the unconscious self and the conscious self. One is simply the transformation of the other. I don't think Paul would say that. That's what Jung makes of that.
You know how the Jews don't see Jesus as the second Christ, and they're still waiting for the second Messiah. So can it still be a metaphor and they're waiting for it, or have they not become Christians?
It's complicated. The way Jung responds to that is to say that that development has been taken up, but in the Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. That the Kabbalah has the transformed God image, which will be the second Adam. And it is, if you remember, it's a balance of male and female. And but it's a marginalized tradition. Yeah. That within the Jewish psyche, there still was this move to transform Adam.
Do they still use the Kabbalah seriously?
I think it's like You know, I think it's, how can I say, it would be like the Masons to Christianity or something like that. Okay. It's a side. Mm-hmm. I know Elie Wiesel, no, he's not. No. I don't know exactly how much they make use of it, to be honest with you.
Madonna's into it?
Well, there's a pop culture version.
There is a deep sort of strata of academic kind of Judaism that takes it very seriously. They've held some things to on North Meridian, right street here.
Yeah. Oh,
they've had some
Reform
Kabbalistic.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
United
Methodist. Yeah, Hebrew target.
Lou
Salome. Lou Salome is her name.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, they brought a guy in.
No, really. Not that. Lou Salome is the girlfriend of.
Hey, we had to get into the Kabbalistic, yes?
See, that's more of my life.
Into the rises.
Well, there's a new book out called The Mystical Kabbalah, and I was curious. It sounded kind of interesting.
It's very interesting. Very. And there was a guy who spoke at JCC on it, too, about a year ago.
Yeah. Well, he just was here.
Yeah, they think there are 10 personifications of God, 10 emanations of God.
Wow.
And some are male and some are female. So you can see how it's evolved, yeah.
Some of my friends and I have gone through a study thing on the Kabbalah a couple years ago, and we also kind of worked it in with the tarot and other kind of mystical things. Paul Foster Case, that was it. But there's some really interesting things in there that kind of go along with a lot of the stuff we study.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like it would puff things up.
Yeah, it's a much broader understanding
and mystical
of what God is about.
Mm-hmm. Any androgynous God images?
They have male and female. There's just the tree of life.
That's
one of the things that you study in the Kabbalah. The lightning, the way down or the way up, where Earth is at the bottom and the Ein Sof R is up at the top, which is the be all end all, the thing you can't name kind of stuff, and it's your journey up and back down, and it's a meditational tool, it's a learning tool, it's a path that you kind of follow to get to enlightenment. And we start, the bottom, I think it's Malkuth, I can't remember, it's the Earth, though. And it's got the sun and the moon, it's got astrology, it's got symbolism of all kinds, Sanskrit symbolism even in some of the stuff. But it's kind of like, it's kind of been a basis for a lot of other mystical teachings and orders and thoughts, ways of getting there. And if you find a fairly decent book on it, it's
very interesting. Yeah. I think it started in Spain around the 15th century. Does that sound right?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Before
it kicked out. Yeah, I think. The last major point last time was this word back. That was on 359. At the end of that first paragraph, he has found his way back to his Christian faith. And, of course, I said the point here is experience wants him to move forward. See, at 359, the end of the last first paragraph. So we are going to move into a really difficult chapter, which we'll have to go very slowly, and I'm afraid. But I wanted to, again, kind of help you not lose the forest for the trees and see the expanse of where we've been, where we are, where we're going. Now we're going to come back to the unconscious producing images of the reunification of the understanding which it wanted to develop with the emotions that had to be separated from. That's going to be the next chapter. And that's the unio corporalis. First you separate understanding from the emotions, and you have a stable position, and then you bring the emotion, the understanding back into the emotions and activate the emotions. And then when that unification has occurred, again, it's not this linear, but this is the way it's been described, then you have the possibility of the inner world and the outer world uniting in a synchronicity, which is the unus mundus. And it's not this, you know, one, two, three, but it's an attempt to look at the different dimensions. Simple, very, very, very simple. Maybe a little bit caricatured explanation of the unio corporalis. Take an alcoholic who stops drinking, and they know they can't go into a bar, because if they go into a bar, those old feelings come back, and they'll start drinking. But as they get stronger in their understanding of how to control their feelings, they can eventually go back into a bar, have a Coke with friends who are meeting after work. Still, they are nervous about it, and not really enjoy themselves. But in further work, they can go back and reanimate their emotions that have fun and go back to that bar and have fun without alcohol. And that's the unio corporalis. The emotions change. So you can go back to the situation that used to threaten you and not be uptight and enjoy it, because you have extracted the meaning out of the emotions' first appearance. I think AA takes people up to and through the unio mentalis. Some people are happy there, some people get frustrated, because it's sterile. It's a sterile position. And you've controlled your behavior, you're not indulging in self-destructive behavior, but you've lost a lot of vitality. And, you know, it sounds awful, I would never say this to anybody, but I have thought to myself, with some alcoholics, you know, I liked you better when you were drinking. Because they were more lively and more vital and funnier, but, of course, they were destroying their lives. I wouldn't say it, and I don't really mean that in the deepest sense, but there's a loss in behavior change. And I just gave you a very simple example. So Tomas's case, it would be to go back to the emotions in that Aurora Sophia experience, which was probably erotic, and be able to live there without being threatened by them. And that's where we'll be going today. I thought, just to prime the pump a little bit, let me reread you parts of page 361, the end of the sixth parable. Because we'll be referring back to some of these themes in this next chapter. The second Adam, see top of 361. Now skip down 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. The second Adam is also male and female, appearing now as the heavenly king or risen Christ, or alchemical Phileus Philosophorum, and now as wisdom or the alchemical earth or world soul. We're going to see all of those in the next chapter. Taken as a whole, the picture is an anticipation of the complete fusion of these two aspects, which form the theme of the seventh and last parable. That's the unio corporalis.
Two aspects.
The spiritual aspect and the worldly aspect. See, one of the points of the Sophie experience is there is no difference between spirituality and material. The spiritual life is living the life you were meant to live. And that's what provides the spiritual satisfaction. That's apokatastasis. What the parable of the philosophic faith, now that was trying to fit this back into the Holy Spirit. Did not quite succeed in bringing off the circulation of the four elements without the exclusion of the fourth, has now become possible. So that means we are going to be able to, we will see in this imagery that the earthly and the spiritual can be united. And although, of course, it's only going to be in images, he doesn't pull this off, but that doesn't stop the unconscious from generating the process that would make that occur. Oh, that's, I think that's enough, just to bring us back into the point where we're picking up.
Well, since it's 5505, we need the point about the quintessence.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, no, that's all I have to say.
Well, read it.
Well, just that all four elements have become one in the quinta essentia, the immortal essence of the second Adam. And that's where you can get a pop. How would you say
that? Abacadastasis.
The cowardly lion would say something like that. In any event, it's just somewhat synchronistic, like you say. Bye, and we'll talk about it.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, let's go to page 362 if you don't have any questions. No questions. First thing 362 does is direct us to the Song of Songs. So we need to spend some time on that, which I've summed up for you in the study guide on page 53. I think it's the most beautiful book in the Bible. And it's going to be a description of the vicissitudes of two lovers, the bridegroom and his beloved.
What is vicissitude?
Chain, developmental back and forth and change. In our text, the text is going to use the bride as an image of the soul and the groom as an image of the body. So that the back and forth between the bride and the groom in our text is going to be the attempt of the soul to reunite with the body.
In our text, where they talk about the groom being the body, they speak of the body at one point as the worldly, as the body on earth, and mm-hmm. then as an immortal essence. So they're not always talking about the human body on earth when they talk about this body. Is that right?
I think they are. We'll have to see when we get there. Hang on to that question and raise it when we get there. The reason I say that is... let's take Jung, for example. He had this little love mess in his life. And I think in working on it, he eventually ended the relationship with Toni Wolff. And out of that, developed an understanding of what the anima was. And so that would be the unio mentalis. And his passions for her, you know, eventually dwindled. So see, that's the loss of the affectivity. What then his anima, I would say, asked him to do was write the 40 volumes, which are Jungian psychology. That then would be the unio corporalis, because the insight was turned into a real product to be made in time and space. Now that product has outlived him, and that's what I would call the eternal aspect of the body in the unio corporalis. It's both mundane and what was the word you used for the other side of the body? You said the text says it's time and space, and you, whatever word you used, I liked. It's time bound and it's timeless. It's both. Immortal, maybe. Did you say immortal?
Maybe.
But you see, the immortality is not to be necessarily understood as anything metaphysical, but as the longevity and the incorruptibility of what you have made. You're never sold out. That was the incorruptibility of the body. We're still talking about it. That's the eternal aspect of the revivified body. The revivified body, in his case, would be his opus, would be his work. I give you a wonderful dream. Or not even a dream, but just to illustrate my point. You know, I was going to read this later, but it's a good place for it now. This is from von Franz's book on dream and death, on dreams and death. It's wonderful if you want to treat yourself to a wonderful read. She wrote a letter, this was quite a while ago, maybe 20 years ago, she wrote a letter to all analysts, and she said, if you have dreams of people right before they died, send them to me. So she got a ton of dreams. And she went through all the dreams, and she looked for their common images. And she wrote the book on, I think there's like 12 chapters, the 12 common images of what people dream right before their death, on dreams and death. And so this is from page 73. She's talking about a guy I'll read you the whole thing. Thus an analysand of mine who was in his middle 50s had the following initial dream. He walked in a field. It was a gloomy atmosphere. The sky was clouded over. Suddenly a slit opened between the clouds and in a ray of sunshine, the shape of a beautiful naked youth was looking down on him. Remember those of you who did dream analysis seminar? He felt an indescribable feeling of love and happiness. The dream frightened me because I thought at once of Hermes, the guide of souls, coming forward and leading the dead into the beyond. As it soon became clear, the health of this man had been ruined during the war, and the analysis became an urgent preparation for his early death. Hermes is the interpreter and ruler of dreams, the mediator in any contact with the contents of the unconscious. But on Etruscan inscriptions, he is also called the Hermes of Hades. As this man lay dying in the hospital, he kept muttering all the while to himself. A friend later reported me, "What does this beautiful Indian woman want from me?" See, that's what Sophia is. Sophia is that sort part of ourselves that wants something from us in time and space.
Which is that beautiful, what kind of woman?
Indian.
India.
East Indian.
Indian?
From India. Here the figure of this guy to obviously become the anima, as in the previously mentioned dream. For a European, Indian means exotic, mysterious, difficult to understand. A still unknown aspect of his own soul comes to the dying man in order to conduct him to the other side. And probably also wanted things from him in time and space. So that's that when the unio corporalis is accomplished, that dream figure, and we're going to see that now in this chapter, which is why I brought this along, we'll see that in this chapter, that aurora, or that Sophia image is set up in the psyche as a guide. And it asks you to do something here on earth. It gives you an assignment. It wants something very specific from you. And that then is the unio corporalis. When you put that into reality, if you are able to not sell out, that's the incorruptible nature of the body. And if it's of sufficient integrity to last beyond your lifetime, that would be the immortal aspect of the body. But it's at the same time a very mundane product. So in that sense, it's just ordinary life.
I thought they were talking about the body in some sort of Catholic sense of an immortal essence that they envision in heaven, or...
But I think they are as a metaphor.
Okay, okay.
As a metaphor. Now, the other complication, which we'll see in this next chapter, is all this takes place in the beyond. It doesn't happen on the earth.
That's why I thought that.
Yeah.
That they weren't talking about any sort of earthly product.
Well, because the unconscious has to produce it in the beyond because there's nobody there to bring it down to time and space. Okay. That's on a stretch, and then we'll pick up with the Song of Songs.